The Wall Street Journal for Tuesday, December 2nd, 2025. Welcome back to The Deep Dive. I'm Alex Vanderbilt. And today we are really embarking on a deep, exhaustive analysis of the day's financial, geopolitical, and cultural source material.
And I'm Sam Astor. And this source stack is particularly heavy. I mean, we're covering seismic shifts in global bond markets, critical defense policy controversies, and you know, some really clear signs of strain across the U.S. consumer landscape.
Mm-hmm.
So our mission for you today is not just to report the news, but to really synthesize every crucial detail. We want to make sure you walk away with the comprehensive insight you need to understand, well, the implications of all these moving pieces.
Okay, let's unpack this. We have to start where the greatest shockwaves are being felt. Global markets, and specifically the volatility hitting digital assets. The consensus among traders seems to be one of just deep, deep unease.
That unease, you see it right away in the cryptocurrency collapse. Bitcoin tumbled more than 6% on Monday.
And 6%, I mean, for crypto, that might not sound like a lot on a normal day.
Exactly. You might think, oh, that's just a routine move. But this specific drop was its biggest one-day decline since March. It settled at $85,468.
Which puts it down a staggering amount from its recent peak.
A staggering 30% from its early October peak, which was, you know, north of $126,000.
And this wasn't just Bitcoin in a vacuum. This felt like a full-scale retreat.
It was. The sell-off pulled down the entire digital token ecosystem. You saw Ether drop 7.6% on Monday. Solana was down about 8%.
And the pain immediately spread to the publicly traded companies.
Yeah.
Coinbase Global, the biggest U.S. crypto exchange, fell 4.8%.
Right. And the complexity you just outlined is exactly why this market retreat is so challenging for investors who have, you know, for the last decade enjoyed cheap capital. This crypto collapse isn't some unique crash.
It's a symptom.
It's the most visible symptom of a much broader retreat from risk across the entire financial system. Investors are liquidating everything. Holdings in unprofitable tech businesses, speculative shell companies, the infamous meme stocks.
When the cost of money goes up, the speculative stuff is the first to go.
It's the first on the chopping block. And this brings us directly to Strategy, the company that, well, famously built its entire corporate strategy around holding Bitcoin.
And they saw their shares drop another 3.25% on Monday.
Which just adds to a slide that has erased nearly half of its market capitalization just this year alone.
Wow.
And Strategy provides the clearest picture of how Bitcoin has sort of transitioned from this revolutionary asset to a more conventional financial instrument that's judged by traditional equity metrics.
So they're trying to weather the storm.
Desperately. They announced plans to raise $1.44 billion through a stock sale. And they specifically earmarked those funds to cover 12 to 24 months of preferred stock dividends.
But wait, the company already holds a massive amount of Bitcoin. 650,000 Bitcoin, right? Valued at about $56 billion.
They do. But here is the critical insight that shows you the depth of the market skepticism. The company's current market cap is trading about $7 billion below the net asset value of its Bitcoin holdings.
$7 below.
That $7 billion delta is not just a pressure point. For the firm, it's a philosophical crisis. Strategy basically acts like a leveraged Bitcoin ETF.
Right.
So when the market values the company at less than the actual Bitcoin it holds, it shows investors fundamentally distrust the management or the strategy or maybe the company's ability to access future capital.
And the CEO even hinted at a major shift.
He did. Michael Saylor himself admitted the company might sell some of its Bitcoin holdings as a last resort if the company's MNAV, its net asset value, trades below one.
That statement fundamentally challenges the whole HODL philosophy, the hold on for dear life idea that Strategy was built on.
It completely undermines it. Saylor is signaling that Bitcoin has become just another conventional instrument, and its retention is subject to traditional corporate finance constraints, not some kind of ideological conviction.
I mean, exactly. And while these Wall Street institutions are trying to survive the crash, we have this fascinating subplot.
Mm-hmm.
It details how a new generation of pretty sophisticated retail investors, U.S. military service members, got into this market in the first place. And it's a stark contrast to all this institutional pain.
It's a really compelling detour into what the source material calls the world's most lethal investing club. The observation is that U.S. military bases have become these hotbeds of investment activity and, you know, competition.
What's driving that? Is it just the culture?
It's a unique cultural and economic mix. You have service members who are often young, they're natural risk takers, and many have built up disposable income through special pay structures.
Right, things like hazard pay.
Post-9/11 hazard pay, family separation allowances, federal income tax exemptions while they're deployed in combat zones. And unlike a lot of corporate environments, military pay is often public.
Ah, so there's no taboo around talking about money.
None. It removes that taboo, and it creates this powerful culture of camaraderie and competition where trading tips are just constantly being shared.
And the data actually backs this up in a huge way.
Oh, it's massive. In 2021, nearly one-fifth, 19.4% of tax returns around bases like Luke Air Force Base in Arizona and Vandenberg Space Force Base in California reported crypto transactions.
And the national average was what, 4%?
Just 4.1%. So we're talking nearly five times the national average.
And there are some fascinating anecdotes of both success and failure.
Absolutely. You take someone like Space Force Captain Gordon McCullough. He's heavily invested in nuclear energy stocks. He's making a strategic bet that the energy voracious AI data center boom is going to drive up electricity demand dramatically.
And has it paid off?
Some of his holdings have doubled since the spring. It just illustrates how these specific educated bets based on global macro trends can yield huge returns.
But the volatility also creates these,
yeah,
these cautionary tales.
Of course. There's a petty officer, Bryson Saunders. He admitted he lost over $10,000 day trading meme stocks and crypto after being drawn in by that base bragging culture.
That's what he do.
He's since shifted to a much more disciplined approach. Index funds, real estate. And now he runs a successful side hustle on TikTok and Instagram, giving financial advice specifically for service members, teaching them how to avoid the same speculative mistakes he made.
Like a whole cycle of financial maturity and fast forward.
Exactly. The easy money culture leads to quick losses, which then catalyzes this desire for sound, long-term financial planning within that specific community.
So, shifting away from crypto, the chaos wasn't limited to digital assets. Global bond markets were violently rattled by some unexpected news.
From the Bank of Japan, of all places, which historically acts as this stable anchor.
So this is a big deal.
This is a globally seismic event, and we really need to understand why. Japan has maintained ultra-low, almost zero, interest rates for decades. It was a defensive measure against deflation, and it's tied to their unique demographic structure.
An aging population.
An aging population means low consumption and persistent downward pressure on prices. So Bank of Japan Governor Kazuo Ueda completely surprised investors by hinting at a potential interest rate increase later this month. He's finally moving away from that zero rate policy.
And the immediate impact.
Japan's 10-year government bond yield shot up to 1.879%. That's its highest closing level since June 2008.
Wow. And when Japan's yields rise, that has a ripple effect.
A huge one. When Japan's yields rise, global yields tend to follow because Japan is just a colossal financial power. The 10-year U.S. Treasury note immediately settled higher at 4.095%.
And the big concern for investors is that Japan is the U.S. government's biggest foreign creditor.
The single largest. They hold about $1.2 trillion in treasuries.
So if Japanese bonds suddenly look more attractive?
Then huge tranches of capital could be repatriated or just pulled away from U.S. debt and other investments. And this would force the U.S. government to pay higher rates to attract other buyers.
Increasing borrowing costs for everyone.
For everyone. From corporations to consumers right across the American economy. So a subtle hint of a rate change from Tokyo translates directly into pressure on your mortgage rate in Seattle or your business loan in Miami.
It just underscores how interconnected everything is.
Completely.
And as a final note on the market's mood, amid all this fear, silver prices actually climbed to new records.
That's the classic flight to safety. That rally was fueled by two things. Expectations that the Fed will cut interest rates further, which often boosts commodity prices, and, you know, heightened concerns over global supply tightness.
So when the speculative stuff gets shaky,
traditional inflation hedges like silver and gold become highly desired safe haven investments.
And the trade policies that are driving some of this global instability are also directly hitting the American consumer and manufacturer. I mean, we're seeing clear signs of strain there. Let's shift our attention to the U.S. economy, maybe starting on the production side.
Right. We have this continued contraction in the U.S. manufacturing sector. The latest data from the Institute for Supply Management shows that manufacturing activity contracted for the ninth straight month in November.
And the PMI, the Purchasing Managers Index, was at what? 48.2?
48.2. And for our listeners, that PMI is critical because any reading below that 50 expansion line signals a contraction in the sector. So 48.2 means we're slipping further into that contraction zone.
And manufacturers seem to be pointing the finger in one direction.
Directly at trade policy. The ISM chair, Susan Spence, was quoted saying, "It really is all about tariffs." They argue that the tariffs make it significantly more expensive for U.S. producers to source necessary materials from abroad.
Which increases their input costs.
Exactly. And those costs can't always be passed on to the consumer.
But hold on. Isn't this contraction partly just a natural global slowdown after all the pandemic stimulus? Or is the source material really saying the tariffs are the only cause?
That is a crucial challenge. And while, yes, global demand has softened, the source material focuses really heavily on the domestic compounding factor, which is judicial uncertainty.
Ah, the pending Supreme Court decision.
Exactly. The manufacturing outlook is severely clouded by that pending decision that could nullify many of the tariffs imposed this year. So manufacturers are hesitant to make long-term commitments. They're holding back on hiring precisely because they don't know what their input costs are going to look like 6 months from now.
Which leads us right to Costco's bold legal challenge. Costco, the third largest retailer in the country, is now suing the Trump administration over the tariffs.
This is a major defensive move by a huge corporation. Costco filed its lawsuit with the U.S. Court of International Trade specifically to secure eligibility for a full refund if the Supreme Court rejects the administration's legal basis for collecting the duties.
And that legal basis is the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, or IEPA.
Right. And the big legal question is whether the administration can use powers that were originally designed to combat things like international terrorism or to manage sanctions.
And apply them to regular trade disputes.
Exactly. The Supreme Court review has been pretty skeptical of the administration's claim of emergency power under IEPA. So Costco is essentially making sure it's at the front of the line for billions of dollars in refunds if the court rules those emergency powers were used illegally.
And the White House has acknowledged the stakes.
They have. They acknowledge the enormous economic consequences if the tariffs are nullified.
So here's where the political calculus gets really interesting.
Uh-huh.
The Trump administration tried to soften the blow on the cost of living concerns by lifting reciprocal tariffs on certain food items.
Right. Bananas, coffee, dozens of others. On the surface, it looks like a major concession to the consumer.
But the devil is in the details.
Always. The analytical layer here is that the scope of this relief is extremely narrow and well calculated. The exemptions cover only $51 billion in imports through August. And while that sounds large,
it's a tiny fraction of the total.
It represents just a third of all food and beverage imports and, crucially, a mere 2% of total U.S. goods imports, which stand at $2.3 trillion.
So the administration gets a political win on the cost of living crisis without really angering politically powerful domestic producers.
That's the move. They focus on products with limited domestic production, like coffee and bananas. Meanwhile, essential kitchen staples, whose costs have been highly elevated since the pandemic, are still subject to these duties.
Things like sugar, cheese.
We're talking about sugar, fish, pasta, cheese, and cooking oils. The tariff rollback will only cut about $2.6 billion in government revenue, which is really just a drop in the bucket compared to the total revenue generated by the remaining tariffs.
So shifting to maybe the most sensitive indicator of economic health, the American consumer, we're seeing clear signs that buyers are drawing a firm line on soaring new car prices.
Which are now approaching a staggering $50,000 average.
Wow.
Consumers are tapped out. After years of shrugging off price increases, the strain on household budgets is now translating into real behavioral shifts in the auto market. Dealers are reporting slower showroom traffic.
And customers are downsizing.
Actively downsizing to cheaper models like the entry-level Chevrolet Trax or just holding out aggressively for significant discounts.
And the financial data backs this up.
It does. We're seeing cars sitting longer on dealer lots, auto loan durations are stretching to record lengths, and maybe most ominously, defaults are rising among lower-income borrowers.
The power dynamic has definitely shifted.
Oh, completely. The source highlights this great anecdote about Peter Tsudo, a resident in Idaho who successfully negotiated a $5,000 discount off the asking price for a Hyundai Tucson Hybrid.
That would have been unthinkable a year or two ago.
Unthinkable? It shows dealers are being forced to compromise on price just to move inventory, a trend we just haven't seen in years.
And a major factor accelerating these depressed sales forecasts for 2025 and 2026 is the collapse of the U.S. electric vehicle market,
which was really hastened by the end of the federal $7,500 EV credit back in September.
So that subsidy shift didn't just hurt sales.
No, it accelerated a whole competitive reset. The expiration of that credit is estimated to have cost the industry hundreds of thousands of potential vehicle sales. The ripple effect here favors established automakers with deeper cost structures who can absorb that price difference.
Over the pure EV startups.
Right, who relied heavily on that consumer price support to make their vehicles competitive. It dramatically changes who can afford to play in the EV space.
And before we leave international trade, there was a really significant pharmaceutical deal struck with Britain that shows how the U.S. is using tariffs to force global policy changes.
Indeed. The UK agreed to a major, unprecedented deal where it will raise the net price paid for new patented medicines by 25%.
And in exchange?
In exchange, the US will avoid slapping crippling tariffs on UK pharmaceutical exports. The US trade representative justified this by arguing that American patients have, for a long time, been unfairly subsidizing global drug costs by paying the highest prices.
The UK was really backed into a corner here.
They were. Their compliance was driven by fear. They were facing an exodus of pharmaceutical investment, including Merck scrapping a half-built $1.3 billion London research center.
And AstraZeneca was pausing a big investment, too.
A $260 million investment. They just needed to stabilize the industry.
So this spending increase is a huge deal for them.
The 25% increase is the UK's first major increase in pharmaceutical expenditure in over two decades. And the implication is significant. It's expected to allow the country to approve new medicines previously deemed too expensive or declined on cost-effectiveness grounds, like certain cancer treatments.
So it's a profound shift in how the National Health Service manages its drug budget.
A profound shift. It moves it closer to the global average allocation for new therapies.
Okay, let's pivot sharply now to domestic policy in sum. Some serious legal and ethical controversies surrounding the Defense Department. The scrutiny of Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth is deepening significantly.
This is a high-stakes, ethically complex situation. It's regarding the September Caribbean boat strikes that resulted in the deaths of two survivors following a second missile strike.
And the scrutiny was amplified by a Washington Post report,
which alleged that Hegseth may have issued a spoken order to kill them all aboard the vessel before that second strike.
The White House has strongly defended the operation.
They have. They stated that Admiral Frank Bradley, the head of Special Operations Command, was acting legally under authority granted by Hegseth, and that he directed the attacks to eliminate the threat posed by the vessel.
And Hegseth himself denied giving that order.
He denied issuing an order to kill the men, writing that the decisions regarding force were entirely Bradley's. But the legal question goes to the heart of military ethics and the law of war.
Because an order to give no quarter is illegal.
It is. Critics, including former State Department legal advisors, argue that an order to attack defenseless individuals like shipwreck survivors violates the Pentagon's own law of war manual, which strictly bars such actions. If Hegseth did issue that command, it's a profound breach of military ethics and international law, regardless of his denial.
And this has triggered urgent bipartisan concern in Congress.
It has. The Republican chairman and the top Democrat on the House Armed Services Committee have planned vigorous oversight and classified briefings this week. They need to determine the full chain of command, the precise rules of engagement that were followed, and whether the secretary, circumvented established legal protocols.
It's a major challenge to his authority and judgment.
A huge challenge. And moving from defense to justice, we have some key judicial scrutiny of the administration's appointment process.
This is about the New Jersey U.S. attorney role.
Right. An appeal court unanimously ruled against the administration's attempt to keep Alina Habba as the acting U.S. attorney in New Jersey indefinitely.
They had tried this kind of clever legal workaround.
Very clever. When Habba's temporary 120-day term was set to expire, they fired her deputy and then reappointed Habba under a different title, Special Attorney and First Assistant U.S. Attorney.
But the appeals court saw through it.
They rejected the maneuver, ruling it inadmissible. And this is a really significant check on executive power. It affirms that the president cannot indefinitely usurp the Senate confirmation process for these crucial U.S. attorney roles by using such internal appointments and workarounds.
It maintains the separation of powers.
Exactly.
We also have two extremely complex Supreme Court cases on the docket this week, both concerning access to justice and First Amendment rights. The first involves a nonprofit pregnancy center in New Jersey.
This is First Choice v. Plotkin. In this case, the Pro-Life Pregnancy Center, which offers support but not abortions, is challenging a subpoena from the New Jersey Attorney General, Matthew Plotkin.
And he's demanding what? Donor names?
Names and contact information for some 5,000 donors. He's arguing he needs to sample whether donors were misled by the organization's mission.
And First Choice argues that this chills their First Amendment rights.
Right, particularly concerning donor privacy, which the Supreme Court has historically protected. They say the subpoena, which also demands internal religious communications and training materials, is just designed to harass them.
And the legal crux here is this concept of legal ripeness.
Exactly. So far, federal judges have said the constitutional rights question isn't ripe because the state court process is ongoing. But critics argue that if an attorney general makes an unconstitutional demand, the federal courts should intervene immediately before the nonprofit spends years in state court and potentially has to hand over sensitive documents.
The court has to decide if it's an issue that deserves immediate federal intervention.
They do. And the second case, Olivier v. City of Brandon, involves a fundamental legal catch-22 for a street preacher in Mississippi.
So Gabriel Olivier was fined $304 for violating a protest ordinance.
And he wants to challenge the future constitutionality of that ordinance. He wants assurance he can continue his First Amendment activity without being fined again. But he was barred from bringing the challenge by a 1994 precedent because he had already been convicted. And crucially, he paid the prior fine.
So because he complied with the penalty, he's blocked from challenging the rule going forward.
It's a brutal catch-22. He potentially has to risk breaking the law again just to get standing to challenge the constitutionality of the ordinance itself. The justices need to decide if applying that precedent in this way unnecessarily restricts First Amendment activity.
And on a very different note of regulation, air travelers are now facing a new hurdle.
That's right, if they haven't achieved compliance with federal identification standards.
Starting February 1st, air travelers without a real ID-compliant form of identification will have to pay a new $45 fee to pass through airport security.
And that fee covers a 10-day travel period and requires the traveler to confirm their identity through a TSA system known as TSA Confirm ID. It basically formalizes the penalty and the extra screening for noncompliance.
Okay, now let's tie infrastructure into this domestic policy update. We can go back to the colossal energy demands driving this whole economic discussion. I'm talking about the fascinating story of Three Mile Island.
A location haunted by a nuclear past, now being revived by the energy needs of the future. The plan is to restart the undamaged reactor, which has been closed since 2019, specifically to power Microsoft data centers.
And this is part of a larger trend.
A national mini-boom, where major tech companies like Microsoft and Amazon are reviving old nuclear reactors to satisfy the huge, nonstop energy appetite of generative AI. Microsoft agreed to purchase electricity from the rebooted reactor for the next 20 years.
To understand the local reaction, you really have to remember the history of the place.
You do. The 1979 accident stemmed from a stuck valve and human missteps, leading to a partial meltdown. At the time, the governor advised the evacuation of pregnant women and preschoolers within a five-mile radius.
And while the government says there were no direct health effects,
the long-term emotional and physical scars remain. And this history has created what the source calls an intergenerational schism in the local community of Middletown, Pennsylvania.
So you have the older residents who remember it all.
Older residents like Beth Drasba, who vividly recalls the fear and chaos of 1979, they are vehemently opposed. They continue to seek answers about long-term radiation effects, and they fear a repeat failure.
And on the other side.
Conversely, younger residents, like 33-year-old Jen Lyons, whose home overlooks the cooling towers, and local business owners, they anticipate the economic uplift. The project brings a $1 billion federal loan and promises 3,400 new jobs.
So they see it as an opportunity.
They see it as a chance to embrace zero carbon energy and technological advancement. They argue that the plant went on to become one of the world's safest facilities, according to Constellation Energy, which is managing the reboot.
It's a powerful dilemma. How do you balance this immense economic and technological ambition with the long-term safety concerns of a community that was directly affected by a previous technological failure?
It's a tough one. And while Three Mile Island is powering the future, New York City is expanding the present with the long-awaited approval of three new downstate casino licenses.
The New York Gaming Facility Location Board finally awarded licenses to all three remaining finalists.
The winners include Mets owner Steve Cohen and Hard Rock with an $8 billion proposal near Citi Field, Genting Group, which will expand its Queens racetrack location into a $5.5 billion full-fledged casino,
and Bally's in the Bronx.
Ally's proposing a $4 billion development next to its golf course in the Bronx. This is a significant widening of gambling opportunities and a move that's going to create major competition for Atlantic City,
which has historically relied so heavily on drawing in those New York bettors.
So heavily.
Okay, let's shift our gaze outward again, because international affairs are revealing some significant geopolitical tension and the active fraying of traditional alliances, especially in Europe.
We've got this split screen that is reinforcing serious, almost existential doubts in Europe about the U.S. commitment to NATO. And this isn't just, you know, rhetorical concern. It's based on observable actions.
So what's on the two screens?
On one screen, you have White House Special Envoy Steve Witkoff making his sixth trip this year to Moscow for peace talks over the Ukraine war, and he is yet to visit Kyiv.
And on the other?
On the other screen, Secretary of State Marco Rubio is skipping the NATO foreign ministers gathering entirely, sending a deputy instead. That's the first time that has happened since 1999.
And Europeans are reading a lot into that divergence.
They're interpreting it as a fundamental shift in U.S. priorities. And what amplified this fear was the leak of a draft peace plan and transcripts of a call between Witkoff and a Kremlin aide. Many Europeans believe the signals the Trump administration is prioritizing improved ties and economic cooperation with Russia over the transatlantic alliance.
The draft plan was a bombshell in allied circles.
A complete bombshell. Europeans believe the contents treat Russia as the clear winner, forcing Ukraine to cede strategic land, significantly shrink its military, and leaving it without essential security guarantees against future invasion.
So Europe feels like it's on its own.
An official from France was quoted as saying, "Europe feels alone." Analysts argue that the U.S. plan would fatally divide NATO by proposing amnesty for Russia for the invasion, allowing its return to the G8, and proposing joint economic development. Russia's goal has always been to defeat NATO politically by undermining its cohesion.
And the difference in goals is profound.
Absolutely. Europeans fear the next war with rearming Russia, and they see the U.S. focus as merely seeking short-term closure. Just let's get this process over the line.
And what's Ukraine's position?
Ukrainian President Zelensky has expressed some cautious optimism that the truce plan looks better after revisions. But the skepticism regarding the U.S. commitment to collective defense is palpable across European capitals.
And Russia is certainly busy strengthening its global position with physical assets.
That's right. Highlighted by a major strategic deal in Africa that has deep implications for global trade security. Sudan's military government has offered Russia what would be its first naval base in Africa.
That is a colossal strategic win for Moscow.
It is. Under the 25-year plan, Russia would gain an unprecedented perch overlooking the critical Red Sea trade routes, a choke point responsible for about 12% of global trade volume and the gateway to the Suez Canal.
And they can station troops and warships there?
Up to 300 troops, and they can dock up to 4 warships, including nuclear-powered ones at Port Sudan or another facility.
So Moscow gains military projection capability and economic benefits.
Significant economic benefits. They get the inside track on lucrative mining concessions, as Sudan is Africa's third largest gold producer. In exchange, Sudan gets advanced Russian anti-aircraft systems to help it pursue its ongoing civil war.
And this severely alarms U.S. security officials.
It does. It intensifies the strategic competition in a very volatile region. This new base is a direct counter to the Chinese naval base in Djibouti, which is only 6 miles from the biggest U.S. military base in Africa, Camp Lemonnier. Russia is seeking to project power and regain the political and financial influence that the Wagner Group used to maintain across the continent.
Speaking of military conflicts, the Ukraine war itself continues to drive rapid innovation. We're seeing these futuristic aerial battles being waged on the front lines.
Often by surprisingly young operators, we are seeing drone-on-drone warfare defining the conflict. Ukrainian forces, notably the 3rd Separate Assault Brigade, are flying high-speed interceptor drones, like the Mirups, which cost about $5,000 each.
And these drones use AI.
They use artificial intelligence to lock on and detonate close to or directly crash into Russian targets, like Mavics and Shaheds.
The technological adaptation is incredible.
It is. The brigade's interception success rate has jumped dramatically from just 5% a year ago to about 50% now. This speaks to rapid software iteration and pilot skill development.
And the human element is remarkable. The pilots are often former computer game developers.
That's right. We have the story of Kratos, a 24-year-old pilot who achieved Ukraine's highest interception tally, over 380 confirmed drone interceptions since January.
Wow.
Including one instance that saved a wounded soldier from an incoming bombing run. It highlights how these video game-honed reaction speeds are now translating directly to critical battlefield success.
Shifting back to U.S. policy, we see another area of, well, cognitive dissonance. Specifically concerning drug trafficking.
That's one way to put it. President Trump is planning to pardon the former Honduran president, Juan Orlando Hernandez.
This is a dizzying reversal of justice. Hernandez was convicted last year of running a violent narco state.
He was responsible for enabling smugglers to ship over 400 tons of cocaine into the U.S. He received millions in bribes, including $1 million directly from El Chapo Guzman in 2013 in exchange for political protection.
And the pardon offer drew immediate controversy.
It did. Critics like Republican Senator Bill Cassidy pointed out the conflicting policies. Why pardon a convicted narco state leader who trafficked 400 tons of cocaine while the administration is simultaneously emphasizing its mission to stop drug smuggling by blowing up small boats in the Caribbean?
It raises serious questions about the coherence of the administration's anti-drug mission.
To say the least.
And finally, on the international stage, we're seeing China's increasingly coercive campaign against Japan.
It's a response that demonstrates Beijing's willingness to use economic might to silence geopolitical opposition. And this all began after Prime Minister Sana Takeuchi correctly stated that an attack on Taiwan would be survival threatening for Japan.
And Beijing's response was immediate.
Immediate and comprehensive. Escalating tensions around disputed islands, diplomatic threats, with one diplomat explicitly threatening to cut off that dirty neck and implementing informal economic sanctions.
Like tourism avoidance orders.
Exactly. Yeah. Leading to an estimated 500,000 airline tickets from China to Japan being canceled in just a few days.
The stakes here are the stability of the Pacific.
And Takeuchi is absolutely right. The fall of Taiwan would break the first island chain, leaving Japan's critical shipping lanes vulnerable to blockade and fundamentally undermining the entire U.S. alliance network in the Pacific. China is demonstrating its willingness to use coercion to silence foreign governments and test the limits of the U.S. security umbrella.
We've covered a lot of global financial and political tension. Let's turn now to the business and technology sectors, where companies are grappling with either, you know, generational opportunity or profound quality control crises.
Circling back to those massive energy demands we discussed, the planned reboot of Three Mile Island is a direct consequence of the massive power requirements of AI.
This decision is driving a mini boom in the nuclear sector.
It is. Tech giants are effectively acting as investors, guaranteeing a stable high demand for power. Microsoft's 20-year commitment to buy electricity for data centers gave Constellation Energy the commercial confidence to proceed with the restart, backed by that billion-dollar federal loan.
And that history is so critical in understanding the local opposition.
The central tension is unavoidable. How does a community weigh the immense economic benefits, the 3,400 new jobs, with the long-term stability and safety concerns of previous technological failure? This schism between those scarred by the past and those eager for the economic future encapsulates a key modern dilemma.
While Three Mile Island is generating power, let's look at a critical industrial sector that is facing some significant challenges in quality control.
Aerospace giant Airbus. They had a terrible week. Their shares fell nearly 6% on Monday following a double whammy of severe quality control issues on its best-selling A320 family jets.
The backbone of many global fleets.
The absolute backbone. First, the company identified a serious supplier quality issue involving defective metal panels on the fuselage, specifically around the cockpit area. The defects were introduced during the stretching and milling process and affect up to 628 jets.
That's a major threat to their financial targets.
A huge threat. Airbus is under extreme pressure to meet its 2025 delivery goal of 820 aircraft. They need to deliver over 160 jets in the coming weeks. Hours of inspection time and replacement work per aircraft could easily cause delivery delays and significant financial penalties.
And the second issue is even more urgent.
A warning issued just days prior regarding a cockpit software glitch on thousands of A320s, about 6,000 aircraft globally. The glitch could potentially cause the jets to pitch downward during a solar radiation event, requiring an emergency regulatory directive for a software fix before the aircraft's next flight.
Wow, so these dual setbacks.
One in manufacturing supply chain and one in critical software are major operational failures that really remind the aerospace sector of the quality control issues Boeing faced previously. It highlights the difficulty of scaling high-tech manufacturing while maintaining safety standards.
We also have a major update on the long-running Tuna Bonds scandal that has plagued the former Credit Suisse.
That's right. Switzerland has filed criminal charges against UBS, which absorbed Credit Suisse in 2023, and a former Credit Suisse compliance officer. The charges relate to money laundering failures linked to that massive 2013 Mozambique debt deal that spiraled into a $2 billion fraud involving cash bribes.
But it's important to note the specific charges here.
Very important. They don't relate to the original fraudulent lending, but rather how Credit Suisse handled client funds in the aftermath. The compliance officer allegedly allowed $7.9 million in suspicious payments from Mozambique's finance ministry to enter the bank in 2016.
And then failed to report them.
And then failed to report the payments to Swiss authorities until 2019, despite numerous indications of suspicion.
And what's UBS's position?
Well, naturally, UBS says it firmly rejects the Attorney General's conclusions and plans to vigorously defend its position. But this saga just continues to highlight significant, deep-seated defects in Credit Suisse's risk management and compliance systems during that period, defects that UBS now inherits.
In the corporate suite, the long-running drama continues at Disney surrounding the search for Bob Iger's successor.
The process has been notoriously difficult. It's been characterized by Iger postponing his retirement 5 times since 2005. The board is now trying to engineer a smoother, less tumultuous transition with the goal of announcing the pick in early 2026.
And the leading internal contenders are Park Chief Josh DiMaro and television head Dana Walden.
They are, and the board's top priority is avoiding the executive brain drain that has characterized previous succession attempts. You can see that in the extension of contracts for several key top executives through 2027 and 2029 to ensure stability.
This period is so critical for Disney as it seeks stability after years of turmoil.
Including Iger, briefly being replaced by Bob Chapek in 2020 before Iger returned in a corporate coup in 2022. The next CEO has to unify the company and navigate the shifting landscape of streaming and intellectual property monetization.
Shifting to how Americans are living and consuming culture, we have data showing that customer patience has officially run out.
A feeling I think every listener can relate to.
Oh, yeah. The latest National Customer Rage Survey found that a staggering 77% of customers reported a service problem in the previous year, a new record high.
And the core frustration is so simple. It is infinitely easier to buy products than it is to get help when there's a problem.
The complaints are extremely specific and relatable. Enduring long automated messages before speaking to a human and just trying to figure out how to contact a company in the first place.
The survey found that customers felt it took a high amount of effort, 68% of respondents, just to resolve their issue.
And technology hasn't been the promised savior here.
Not at all. While companies are pushing AI chatbots to handle complaints, customers gave them ambiguous or modestly unfavorable ratings for effective complaint resolution. And compounding the issue is the stratification of customer service, where only higher tier members are getting direct access to special phone lines and human support.
The average customer is just left to fend for themselves in an automated maze.
Exactly.
Moving into cultural consumption, we have a fascinating career and business shift from comedian Jim Gaffigan.
Gaffigan, who was previously famous for his family-friendly comedy and, you know, his observations about hot pockets and laziness, has completely pivoted to a niche market. He released a 45-minute special focused entirely on liquor called The Bourbon Set.
And his transformation into a full-blown bourbon nerd during the pandemic was the catalyst.
That's right. This obsession led him to launch his own bourbon company, Father Time, with a college friend.
But the business model is what's most insightful here.
It is. Gaffigan bypassed major streaming platforms like Netflix entirely. He chose instead to self-release the niche special for free on YouTube, sponsored by Old Forester.
It demonstrates a really creative monetization model for established comics.
It allows them to target highly specific audiences and retain control over their intellectual property without giving up massive cuts to streamers.
On the sports front, the NFL provides a sharp lesson in strategic miscalculation, specifically regarding quarterback management and the salary cap window.
Starring the Minnesota Vikings. They embarked on an expensive strategy that has utterly failed, they decided to let their veteran quarterback, Sam Darnold, walk to Seattle,
where he is now succeeding, leading the Seahawks to a 9-3 record.
Right. And they did this to invest heavily elsewhere and rely on a cheaper rookie quarterback, J.J. McCarthy. The Vikings spent over $300 million on other players in the hopes of capitalizing on McCarthy's low-cost rookie contract window,
making them the most expensive team in the NFL by cash spending.
But the outcome has been disastrous. McCarthy, the number 10 pick in 2024, has been injured and ineffective, throwing only 6 touchdowns against 10 interceptions in 6 career games. Their current 4-8 record demonstrates that the perceived cap savings from the rookie contract were rendered obsolete by the lack of performance at the game's most critical position.
It's a classic example of mismanaging the most valuable asset in the sport.
Completely. And this contrasts sharply with the bizarre conversation happening in college football, which the source material accurately calls college football brain.
Highlighted by Lane Kiffin leaving Ole Miss for LSU, then lobbying to coach Ole Miss in the upcoming college football playoff.
Kiffin's former boss, Nick Saban, actually supported the idea, which just exemplifies professional circumstances being treated as a folksy campus endeavor. No other high-stakes business would let an employee who just took a job with a direct competitor stick around for the big finale.
It reveals a unique and often absurd lack of professional boundaries in that highly monetized sport.
It really does.
Finally, looking at television, 2025 offered some critically acclaimed shows, both foreign and domestic.
The source notes the critical success of American shows like Dying for Sex, which was called audacious, outrageous, and memorable for following a woman's reaction to a stage 5 cancer diagnosis by seeking the sex and desire she had been missing. Also earning high praise was Task, a kinetic crime journey.
Yet the source notes the continued high quality of imported British television.
Citing shows like Adolescence, a harrowing drama masterminded by Stephen Graham, which was filmed in 4 uncut takes. This demonstrates a high production ambition that often separates UK and US television output.
So this deep dive has woven together threads of unprecedented market volatility, the fraying of traditional alliances, from the tension in the Red Sea to European concerns over NATO, and the increasing complexity of balancing technological ambition with fundamental stability.
Right, whether that means ethical defense policy or just providing stable customer service.
And this brings us back to one of the most pressing underlying themes reflected across the paper's pages, from the front page defense controversies to the op-ed section, the race toward artificial intelligence. We read the argument that the U.S. is prioritizing AI firepower without a comparable investment in making these systems steerable and secure.
And Frontier AI Labs expects systems matching human experts across all cognitive domains within 12 to 18 months.
The risk is enormous. Research shows AI models can harbor undetected sleeper agents triggerable by adversaries.
A concern heightened by evidence of Chinese penetration of Frontier AI Labs. Advocates are calling for dedicated funding for AI alignment research, ensuring these systems' objectives stay stable and predictable, and requiring military-grade alignment R&D and defense contracts, like verified shutdown protocols.
So if we connect this to the bigger picture, given the current military focus on rapid innovation, like the drone interception in Ukraine, and the high stakes of AI integration into national security, we have a clear dilemma. We've seen chaos and profound ethical scrutiny surround human decision-making, like the Hegseth controversy and the potential violation of the Law of War manual. This raises an important question. In this race to develop lethal new technology, how does the military ensure that its pursuit of advanced AI systems doesn't inadvertently create the very sleeper agents or unstable systems that adversaries like China are systematically guarding against, thereby winning the race not through capability, but through control?
Thank you for joining us for this deep dive into the source material. We look forward to continuing this exploration with you soon.